One of the blessings of life in our region is that we are close to nature, sometimes very close. Deer sightings are common in many of our towns. Cougar sightings, less common, but not unheard of. There are lots of other critters, big and small, that come around from time to time. Do we welcome them? Do we try to fence them out and kill them? We do have mixed feelings and mixed actions as well. Our guest this hour wants us to consider what's out there. Lyanda Lynn Haupt wrote the book The Urban Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild. Lyanda does not just write about wildlife. She created and directed education programs for the Seattle Audubon Society. She rehabbed raptors in Vermont and researches seabirds for the Fish and Wildlife Service. She's written a pile of articles and three other books. Lyanda Lynn Haupt, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So would you say your overall goal is to make us all more aware of our connections to nature?
Absolutely. You know, I think that one of the things that I'm passionate about is the idea that daily connection to that natural world really does make us more intelligent, it makes us healthier, it makes us more vibrant, and it makes us happier. And yet, we all sort of carry around this notion that going into nature somehow means getting into the SUV and driving to that place that you see on the Sierra Club calendar, that kind of pristine, dappled stream, someplace that's untouched by humans, untrammeled by, you know, the hand of man. And we go there and we refresh our spirits and then we come home again. And what I want to say is that if that is our idea of what nature is, then my idea, that daily connection with nature, is in a lot of trouble. And I want to argue that any of us that have a window or a door that opens have access to some contact with the natural world, and that it's time to start cultivating that.
So we need not consider vast areas of thousands of acres of wilderness as nature, because the fact is it's around us all the time.
It's around us all the time. I mean, I don't want to say that the nature in cities or in urban or kind of semi-urban places like where you are in Ashland are enough that, you know, sort of the scrappy species that live among us are the ones that are able to live with humans. And conservation of the much broader diversity of species that are far beyond us in more pristine and remote wilderness areas is really, really important. But what I do want to say is that observation of the animals that do live among us is kind of a thread, sort of a connection between everyday nature that we see every day and wilder nature, animals that we will never see but that we still care about.
We can't even agree on the pronunciation of the book in our offices. Do you say bestiary or bestiary?
You know, Jeffrey, you may say either, and either are correct. I say bestiary just because it, you know, invites the idea of the beast a little bit more clearly, but bestiary is also correct.
So what is a bestiary or bestiary?
I love the form. It's a medieval book form, and they started in about the 12th century. The one that I sort of took as an inspiration for this book is called the Aberdeen Bestiary, and it was penned in a monastery on vellum, you know, actual animal skin pages.
Goat skin, wasn't it?
Yeah, goat skin. In those days, sometimes they used calf skin, but so it's just, that picture in our imagination is exactly right of the sort of sad, bleary-eyed young monk sitting on a stool with nothing but a candle and his, you know, quill pen filling in this giant sort of volume. And what the bestiaries were being filled with was every kind of information known about animals at the time. So there were pages of descriptions of individual animals and groups of animals. And what's super interesting about medieval science is that it was this crazy blend of really good observation of animals, assumptions about animals, and absolute conjurations about animals, just things that were just made up. And all of these things were put alongside one another as if they were equally true. Sometimes even the animals themselves were made up, some, you know, unicorn-like animals, but even more fantastical than that, different, you know, dragons and mammals that had different, that had parts of reptiles. So all of this was alongside, you know, just perfectly good descriptions of everyday animals like doves or beavers. Another thing that was interesting in the bestiaries of the time was that they were allegorical. So science was mixed up totally with the religious morality. So something like a jay, you know, like we have Stellar Jays up here, and you have Blue Jays there in Ashland, or Scrub Jays, the chattering and the loud sounds that these birds would make would be a warning against us to stop blathering so much and get busy studying scripture. And we should instead follow the model of the quiet dove, who is so, you know, peaceful and gentle. And because she's so peaceful and gentle, God will warn her of the presence of the hawk overhead and save her. And we should cultivate that as well. So there's always that kind of allegory. So what I wanted to do in my bestiary was sort of bring that form up to date and say that I don't make things up in this bestiary. I don't make up animals. They're all about animals that we can go out and see pretty much without a lot of trouble, mostly common animals. But I do feel that knowing about animal tracks, natural history, and science belongs right alongside other beautiful, valuable ways of human knowing, like poetry, mythology, and folklore, and just everyday storytelling that we share among ourselves. So I wanted to bring all those beautiful ways of human knowing about animals together in one place. And that's why I called it a bestiary.
Lyanda Lynn Haupt on the Jefferson Exchange from 2013, talking about the urban bestiary. You can call it bestiary, too. We'll come back to this interview. And a reminder that we can't take any new phone calls or emails today because it is pre-recorded. You'll hear the rest of it starting in a minute 20. You write of a bestiary, Lyanda, helping us locate ourselves in nature, but in fact, it seems you struggle a bit with the very term nature. Why?
Well, I think that we use the word nature, we sort of equivocate on what we mean by the word nature. We talk about, as we were discussing before the break, you know, nature is something untouched by the human world and what I are the human realm or human doings. And I invite instead an idea that I call the new nature. And the new nature is kind of a reluctant understanding. It means that we have to finally kind of give up our romantic sense of a nature somewhere out there. And it's reluctant because that sort of pristine nature appeals to us. You know, it appeals to our sense of adventure, our sense of intellectual repose, our, you know, spiritual calm. We love the idea that there's a place where humans have no presence and our doings don't matter. But we know now, Jeffrey, right, because of all the habitat destruction and more than that, the global effects of climate change, that there is no place, whether humans are actually living there or walking around in natural places or not. Every place is touched by what humans do in our daily lives. And so that's kind of a disconcerting notion, but I want to try to spin the positive side of that and say there's something poetic about that, which is that if this is true, that our daily lives are really connected to all of the earth, then everything that we do matters, and it gives meaning to our lives, it gives meaning to our actions, and there's something wondrous about that, and something that can be really inspiring instead of just foreboding about that.
So if we redefine nature, we can see ourselves as a bit closer to nature. It doesn't have to be these, as we talked about, these huge multi-thousand-acre tracts of land, but little clumps here and there. I mean, the fact is that we're not quite like the spotted owl. We don't need the contiguity, but we certainly like to have a little bit of nature near us.
Right. And when we pay attention to that close to home nature, it's a connection on another level to that spotted owl. You know, the birds in our neighborhood make us remember that there's more out there as well. And we were talking about how the old bestiaries were allegorical, how they had a moral to them. And I think that if there is a moral to my new bestiary, it's just the idea that the more we understand the wild animals that share our homes, really the better all of us can coexist in safety, in wisdom, and in delight. Because when we hear a lot about, you know, urban wildlife, about coyotes coming into, you know, the schoolyard, or raccoons getting in the kitchen and all this stuff, we talk about conflict, and we talk about fear, and we talk about disease. And I think it's important to be smart and really have a clear sense of what's going on with these animals, how to safely interact with them, And once we know that, once we can get beyond kind of the hyped up misinformation that leads to a lot of the fear, then we can coexist really well and kind of enjoy the enlivened city that places that allow, you know, the more than human world to flourish can give us. You know, if we're clubbing everything to death just because it's getting too close to our house, our cities are going to start to be really boring and really dull. But if we find out that, you know, enough about the animals that live with us to live alongside them well and safely, then we've got a lot more going for us.
There's a concept in here that I hadn't heard of before, urban tracking. You're not actually advocating hunting down critters in town, are you?
I'm absolutely not. And in fact, even in the kind of wilderness tracking right now, tracking is becoming a very popular natural pastime. It used to be something that we thought of as something for the realm of just hunters. But now people are just honing their tracking skills just so that they, when they go out into the natural world, they can have a better sense of what's going on out there. Just, they're just becoming better naturalists and better scientists. And I want to say that we can bring some of these skills. We don't even have to go out to a woodland trail to practice tracking. We can bring a lot of those skills right into the urban landscapes in which we live, or semi-urban, suburban landscapes in which we live. And I talked to a lot of famous trackers, and they totally agreed with me. And what we all came up with was the idea that you have to remember that an animal track sitting there in the mud or the snow isn't the only thing that you're looking for if you're a tracker. I mean, some of these trackers, if you go out with a real tracker, Jeffrey, it's really amazing because they'll look in a piece of, you know, a little blob of sand, and they'll see one little toenail mark, and they'll tell you exactly what rodent made it and how big it was and whether it was pregnant and how long ago it was there. And
wow,
now that it's 5 hours later, where it probably is and what it's probably doing. So it's just incredible if you ever get a chance to go tracking with a master tracker. It's kind of worth, you know, blowing your mind to do it. But we don't have to, pretend to aspire to that kind of mastery. Instead, what we notice are not just tracks. If there's mud at the edges of our gardens or our urban park pathways or our sidewalks, I always look and see what I can find. Usually it's a dog track, right? But occasionally there's an opossum or there's some kind of bird or there's a raccoon track to be found. But fortunately, since we have so much concrete in our city and real tracks are hard to find, there's lots of other things we can look for. And trackers call this sign. So they're looking for track and sign. And sign can be any of the other little kind of left behind moments of the daily story that animals offer. So it can be a feather. It can be the scratchings on the bottom of a tree that a raccoon or a porcupine left. It can be, you know, the chestnuts or the hazelnuts that are left open. And you can tell by the size of the hole in the nuts what kind of bird opened them up. You know, a crow will hack something open, and a chickadee will peck a tiny little hole in something, or clean up the nut that was already opened and eaten by the bigger birds. We're looking for scats, poop from mammals or birds, pellets that birds have sort of coughed up, in which you can find berries and you can find bits of, you know, shimmering insect wings. So there's all kinds of little animal signs among us that if we just sort of go about our day with an increased awareness, letting these things in, well, it's amazing how much more that we find and how fun it is to realize that we're not just humans out there tromping around on human sidewalks, but instead we're part of this ongoing daily emerging story that includes so many more creatures than just us ourselves.
Not always visible, but certainly always around us. The book is divided into three major sections: the furred, the feathered, and the branching and the rooted. The branching and the rooted as one section. How did you make the choices for which creatures would get chapters in the book, Lyanda?
You know, it was really hard. I think that was the hardest part. And the cutting room floor of this book is longer than the book itself, really, because there were so many animals that I wanted to include. And I just imagine everyone reading this book saying, well, why didn't she write about, you know, pocket gophers, or why didn't she, you know, everybody has their favorite animal that is probably missing from this book. So the main reason, I mean, what I wanted to do in choosing the animals was to choose representative animals of each kind of major sort. So the coyote is the representative sort of top predator that lives at the edges of urban habitats. the squirrel is the rodent, although we throw in rats or kind of make an appearance in the squirrel chapter as well. Birds were really hard because while there aren't really that many mammals, I mean, there are a lot, but compared to birds, there just aren't that many in urban places. There can be hundreds of species of birds in an urban environment, and I could only pick a few for this book. So I picked chickadees for the kind of representative cute garden bird just because I think that they can hold their own as a, you know, representative of all the others. So I tried to take the various categories of kinds of animals, of the kinds of human responses and conflicts that they present, and just, you know, hit all the major test cases. And then in the end, I threw a few sort of offbeat beasts in there. One of them is tree, which I treat as a presence in the urban landscape that we can have a relationship with. And when I started writing my tree chapter, I thought it was really an original thing to do, to put, you know, trees, which are plants, in a bestiary, which is ostensibly about beasts. But when I studied my model, the urban bestiary, or the Aberdeen bestiary, I saw that way back in the 12th century, they actually included trees in their bestiaries as well. So
somebody beat you by a millennium.
I know, they totally did. So it wasn't that interesting or original after all. And the same with humans. I really wanted humans to be kind of an animal presence in this bestiary, recognizing that we're a unique one, to be sure. And I thought that would be original. And, of course, the Aberdeen bestiary beat me on that level as well.
So. Right. The book that we're talking about here is The Urban Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild. Lyanda Lynn Haupt is the naturalist and speaker and writer who wrote it. This is a version of the exchange from our archives. It is pre-recorded, so we're not giving out the phone number and the email address today because we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Thanks. Jeannie in Medford didn't stay on the line. She wants to know how feeding feral or wild animals affects interactions with domestic animals.
Oh, well, that's, you know, feeding animals is one of the ways that we most quickly come into conflict with wild animals and bring wild and domestic pets into conflict. So, I mean, and there's lots of different ways we can do this. So if we're just talking about bird feeders, it's one of those things. I'm absolutely, someone accused me of being against bird feeding, which is silly. Of course I'm not. I have a little feeder that has suction cups that's stuck to my study window that's mm-hmm. 2 feet in front of me right now, and there's actually two chickadees sitting on it right now. So I'm not against bird feeding, but what I'm against is this idea that we kind of, if you love animals, the first thing you do is put up a bunch of bird feeders. And it causes problems because they attract, people often don't keep them clean, so that can bring diseases to the birds that visit them that we're trying to attract. And then they attract all kinds of other things that we don't really want eating our expensive bird feed. Squirrels are the main one that drives us all crazy. But they can also invite rats, raccoons, coyotes, and bears. So if we put out bird feeders, we've got to be really careful about what is, you know, what's coming to them, and consider removing them at certain times of year or keeping them up really high if they're attracting bears, or taking them down altogether if we seem to be attracting things that are causing problems. Now, as far as our pet food, our cat food, and our dog food that we leave out, that almost no matter where you live in an urban or suburban place, once the sun goes down, that's going to attract both raccoons and opossums. And if your animals are out at night and the raccoons and the opossums and your cat or your dog are there, that can invite conflict between those animals, which is something we absolutely want to keep at a minimum. Because for the most part, wild animals want to avoid our animals. They don't see our own animals see our backyards as their territory, whereas the other animals that come, opossums and raccoons, they're just wandering through. They see it as part of a bigger territory. So if they met our dog, you know, a few blocks away from our house, everyone would probably just ignore each other. But if they meet our dog in our backyard, where our dog thinks it's his backyard, right?
Right.
Then there's going to be a conflict with the dog and the raccoon that need not exist. So keeping food in, bringing cat food and dog food in at night is one of the core elements of, I think, coexisting well with the wild animals in cities and suburbs.
For that matter, Lyanda, do you recommend closing down kitty and dog doors for the night?
I do. You know, I've heard so many stories about raccoons coming in through dog doors and also rats coming in through cat and dog doors. So it's the safest thing for our animals, and it's the safest thing for wild animals to kind of decrease that permeability between our homes, especially at night.
All right, close the turnstile down. Let's take a call from Steve in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Her book is The Urban Bestiary.
Howdy. I'm 68 years old, and when I was growing up in Eugene, we never saw possums around. Mm-hmm. Now they're not prevalent, but they are around. We've also got stuff like Himalayan blackberries and Scotch broom, which are foreign invasive species. And I wonder how much humanity as a whole has had a role in changing the nature of the population of the urban bestiary.
All right, the stuff around us, how much we've changed. Thanks for the call, Steve.
Well, Steve asked a very important question. And, of course, our role and our impact has been tremendous. The opossums are a really interesting kind of case in point, because one of the things people say about opossums is that they don't belong here. You probably know, Jeffrey, that they're a marsupial. They're the only marsupial that we have in North America. People sort of identify them with rodents. I think it's because they have those long, ratty tails.
Right.
They actually have a pouch, you know, like a kangaroo. Their babies are born and crawl into the pouch where they're raised. So that's kind of a wonderful thing about opossums. So they were native in this country to the southeast. And what happened with opossums was that the pioneers moving from east to west in the early part of the last century started picking up opossums and bringing them along. And they did this for a couple of reasons. Mainly, they would capture them live and bring them so they'd have a good fresh food source without worrying about hunting too much. Another thought that they had was that they would release them as they went along as fur bearers, so that they'd establish populations and they'd be able to provide fur for their generation and future generations. And we don't really think of the fur of opossums as being that attractive, but you know, we don't like their long kind of scabby tails, and we don't like their big toothy snouts. But once you get rid of those two things, the pelage on an opossum is really soft and very beautiful and warm. So that idea made sense. But a couple things started happening. One is that they realized that, for one thing, they didn't like eating opossums that much. And so they started letting them go. But the other thing that started happening was that the children started falling in love with the opossums, because they were so gentle and so tameable, and they made the best pets and best friends, as good as any cat or dog.
Wow.
They were very snuggly. They loved to have their bellies rubbed. They're entirely tame and very placid. And so people just kept them around and carried them all the way west. So people view them here, I'm in Seattle, and so where I live and where you live, people view them as introduced species. But the truth of the matter with opossums might be that they were already expanding their range very slowly before, you know, the pioneers started giving them rides across the country. And it's altogether possible that they would have expanded their range this far in any case. But so the opossum is kind of a wonderful story, but Steve's right. I mean, we're putting in concrete, we're putting in lots of houses, we're removing native botanical species and replacing them with garden species. Some of that works out ecologically, some of it doesn't. And so there's a move these days really to concentrate on more botanical complexity in our neighborhoods, planting more levels of plants, planting more trees, planting more native plants. That will help bring in more native species of birds and animals as well.
Lyanda Lynn Haupt from 2013, talking about her book, The Urban Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild, the encounters between critters and people as we move into their habitat. We'll come back and hear more of this. Again, it is pre-recorded, so no new phone calls and emails. But back on the Jefferson Exchange with Lyanda Lynn Haupt in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Lyanda Lynn Haupt joined us in September of 2013 to talk about her book about people and critters in close proximity, The Urban Bestiary. Since it is pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Here's the final portion of that interview. Lyanda, we were just talking about opossums and some of the interesting things about them. Now, granted, not everybody will want to take them in as pets, as in the example you gave, which raises the question. The opossums are actually in a chapter after raccoons in your book, and I want to talk about them in the same paragraph. Are we tougher on the uglier animals? Because raccoons are certainly more charming physically than opossums to most people.
Right. It's really funny. I think that we are. You know, we teach our kids not to judge others on appearance, and yet with these animals, that's exactly what we do. I mean, look at rats and squirrels. Most people, even if squirrels really are causing problems for them and they're eating all the sunflower seeds they put out for the chickadees and driving them crazy, most people admit that squirrels are pretty darn cute and they have those fluffy tails. And then you take something like a rat, which can also have, you know, they have these pretty big ears. If you look at a picture of them without their tail, they're super smart. We know they make good pets. They come when they're called. They like to live in our pockets, you know. But we just can't get past the tail. And so whereas we can tolerate the squirrels no matter how much trouble they are, the rats, we just can't bite. And the same is true on a more complicated level, even, I think, with raccoons and opossums. Because raccoons wreak all kinds of havoc. I mean, they really, you know, they nest in our attics. They, you know, they can tear up the electrical. They're really, you know, if we can just keep our houses in order and we keep things in good repair, we can prevent that kind of conflict. But, you know, raccoons are busy, troublesome, smart creatures. But they've got those front paws that look just like a human hand. They've got those masks that we equate, you know, with thievery and banditry, but with which also make them look just kind of adorable. They've got this little white line down the middle of the forehead that makes them look so cute and anxious. And no matter how much trouble raccoons cause for us, most people find it in their hearts to think that they're just still pretty darn cute. Now, opossums, people hate opossums unapologetically, and it's one of the things that I didn't expect when I was researching this book, but I learned over and over again that, because I just kind of thought, you know, I was kind of indifferent to opossums. They look kind of slow and myopic and maybe not that smart, but there was nothing to really despise in them. But I found out that they are actually really smart. They are still slow moving, but they're not slow in terms of their animal intelligence. And they're not even that myopic. They're just, their nocturnal eyes just make them look kind of a little bit unfocused when they see them in daylight. But they've got these long stringy tails. They've got these snouts that are full of teeth. They actually have 50 teeth, Jeffrey, so that's more than any other mammal in North America.
Wow.
It's the same amount of teeth as a T-Rex.
Jeez.
So we think that's just too many teeth for something, you know, that small. On the other hand, another funny thing about opossums is even though they are very gentle, the times that we see them are usually when they're cornered, you know, in our garage or something like that. And so they're totally freaked out. They think that we're going to kill them. And so they try to make themselves appear as big and scary as they can. So they bare all those 50 teeth, and they really do look horrible at these times. So this is what we base our judgments on. Opossums on. And we don't have a lot more to go on because they're nocturnal, so we don't get to really just hang out with them in kind of an everyday way and see what they're really like. But the truth about opossums is, whether or not we like how they look, they're very gentle, they're very quiet. Unless they're cornered, they're not going to confront you, they're not going to bite you or chase after you, they're going to avoid your cats. So they're just no problem.
All right. Lyanda Lynn Haupt, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Urban Bestiary. This is a pre-recorded edition of The Exchange, so you're not going to hear the phone number and the email address given out because, since we're pre-recorded, we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Let's take another call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. A story, a comment, and a question, if we have that much time.
We do.
My significant other moved up from Los Angeles and is a night person. I'm an early morning person. We live on the urban forest interface. One morning I was down at our house having breakfast. She called me on the cell phone, which miraculously found itself 2 years later in a strawberry bed. And she said, there's a bear in the yard. I said, really? What's it doing? She said, it's looking around. And you have to understand, we have a lot of blackberries. And I said, okay, fine. You're in the house, right? Yes. What are the dogs doing? Well, they're barking at it from a distance. Okay, they're doing what they're supposed to do. And eventually, the bear climbed the fence, knocked down a panel of fence, and left. And when I came home, I put the panel of fence up, and that was that. That's the usual kind of encounter that I've always had with any kind of wildlife. We have 4 cats, 2 dogs, and now 1 heritage turkey who claimed political asylum. He flew in. And in any event, that's always the way it's been. We've defined a space on the larger property that's ours. And the animals stay, our domestic animals stay inside that, and the rest is for the wild things. Now, the one thing I'm adamant about is that the cats stay inside, because we do have cougars, we do have foxes, we do have coyotes, you know, and all of those other animals. And what you say about feeding the animals, we feed once a day, and everything is indoors when they're fed. And that makes a huge difference in terms of attracting things. Now my question is twofold with this bourbon red tom turkey. First of all, if there's any listeners in the area who happen to have a couple of hens they'll let go of, I'd greatly appreciate it. But I'm thinking about enclosing the space he's in with true predator fence instead of the open panel cattle panel I've got. Mm-hmm. Is that going to stop most of the predators that would come after a turkey like that?
All right. Thanks for the story and the question, Paul.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so I just want to comment on Paul's story, because Paul is awesome, and he's doing everything right. He's got that idea of you're seeing a bear in your yard. You don't need to freak out. You don't need to call Fish and Wildlife. You don't need to get a gun. You just need to sort of assess the situation and say, where are the dogs? Where are you? Is everyone safe? Great. Then, as he said, everyone is where they're supposed to be, and that is really what sort of the peaceable kingdom about the urban wilds is about. You know, it's not about feeding bears from your hand. It's not about inviting, you know, raccoons to live on blankets in your attic. It's about everything just being where it's supposed to be. Paul's got a great handle on that, and I loved his thought as well about keeping cats inside, because I'll hear a lot of people just. So many people will say, I love having coyotes and I love having raccoons in urban places, but I'm freaked out about my cat, and don't tell me to keep my cat inside because I'm just not going to. And then you just kind of have to throw up your arms and say, look, if we're going to have a multi-level, this kind of enlivened city that urban wildlife can bring, then it's going to involve just a little bit of inconvenience. And that's one of those things. And Paul obviously has that great, you know, realistic sense about that. So about the turkey, is Paul still there or is he gone?
He's gone.
Okay. So I keep poultry in the city. I keep just chickens. Mm-hmm. And the best thing to do for protecting urban poultry is to give them a large enough, you know, run that if they're going to be alone in the day, they really do need to be protected from all sides, even overhead, because raccoons can definitely, turkey is a big animal for a raccoon, but a raccoon is a lot of animal. And so they can climb all the way over things, as can a coyote. So a run that is enclosed on the top, and it can be with what's called chicken wire is a little bit flimsy, but hog wire, that 2-inch by 4-inch solid fencing, is usually pretty good. The other thing I would recommend for any kind of poultry is to close it up in a strong coop at night, closed all the way up and locked. And it has to be locked really well, because raccoons are very good with those little slide latches.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're really good. They can they can work locks, and then they can remember for a long time how they did it. I learned lately that they can't just, not only can they untie knots, but they can actually tie knots.
Wow.
Which is kind of disconcerting. So,
talented animals. We have another email here from Tim in Eureka. He says, we had semi-free-range chickens in our backyard here in Eureka, which attracted a skunk. And yes, our dog got skunked, and I thought we had to move. But we used a formula of 1 quart hydrogen peroxide, quarter cup of baking soda, and 2 tablespoons of Dawn dish soap. That worked magically. Forget tomato juice. Anyway, we have a plum tree that has never produced fruit. I have seen the blossoms and the green fruits, but never any plums. The chickens are gone now, but the skunk has made a home, and now we have plums. I think the skunk keeps the raccoons and possums away from eating the plums. That, again, from Tim in Eureka.
That's absolutely possible, and that's a great story. I mean, that's a great story on many levels. One is that when you bring, you know, urban chickens are really popular right now, kind of trendy, but when you bring them in, it invites all kinds of other things that people weren't necessarily bargaining for. And I like to reframe that not necessarily as conflict or kind of, you know, humans and their gardens being at war with wild, but kind of going, okay, this requires a creative response, and it looks like he came up with one. As far as the skunk keeping away the fruit-eating animals, it's altogether possible. Great solution.
All right, good to know. Boyd in Wolf Creek, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lyanda Lynn Haupt. Her book is The Urban Bestiary.
Good morning. Thank you for your guest. I had a happy ending wildlife story. Very quickly was getting to know wood rats and how industrious they are and their curiosities. I was camping outside and had to get up early in the morning to go birding. And put a valuable heirloom family wristwatch by my pillow to keep track of time, and woke up and it was gone. And I had heard that the wood rats were interested in glittery things, and there was a nest about 215 feet away from where I was camping. And I took the nest apart, treed the wood rat, and found the wristwatch.
I love that story, and it reinforces the idea that if you understand the lives of animals, it decreases conflict, because here he'd heard that the wood rats like shiny things, and he used that information to get his watch back, which I love. And, you know, Jeffrey, it also made me think, one of the things that my family and I do, which we didn't realize how eccentric it seemed until we started talking to people about it. There's the two of us, and we have a teenage, almost 15-year-old daughter, and much of the year, we sleep outside. We sleep in the tent in the backyard. And what's really fun about that, we kind of did it just because we can take the rain fly off parts of the year, and we can watch the stars, and it's really pleasant and it's cozy back there. But the other thing that it's done for us is made us realize that the night world, even here in Seattle, it's just mayhem out there. I mean, we hear especially raccoons trilling. There's a family of raccoons out there. We never see them during the day, but at night they're out there making so much noise, and the opossums are quiet, but if they get in the chicken coop, they start tinkling at the food dish, reminding me that I have to close the coop up. And it's just crazy out there, so much so that every morning when I come out, I expect everything to be torn up and the benches to be tipped over, and I walk out there and everything looks best as it ever was. Cracks me up. So as the cold weather comes on and we're moving back inside, it's really pleasant to remember that all of this is still going on out there.
I want to talk about coyotes before we go, because there's a great story about a coyote who got trapped in Seattle and bolted into a building and got caught in an elevator and everything. But it gets down to the question of, why do coyotes seem to do better than many animals at growing in number, despite how much human population has covered the planet?
Well, one of the things about coyotes is that they are they're omnivorous, they're adaptive, they're scrappy, they're opportunistic, and they're smart. So a lot of the animals, when we come into the landscape, and when we enter into a habitat that used to be habitat for wild animals, and we start laying down concrete and building houses and simplifying the landscape, most species simply cannot live here anymore. So, you know, we have maybe 20 species of birds that we'll see regularly, and then we'll have, you know, a few species of mammals, and nothing else can really live in that simplified landscape. But the scrappy, opportunistic, and intelligent animals like coyotes and crows and raccoons can really thrive here. So the way that intelligence comes into play with coyotes is, I think, in the way that they've changed their behavior to live among people. And I find this absolutely fascinating. So coyotes that live in wilder places where there are fewer humans are actually quite crepuscular. They're active during the day. They'll sort of wander around for a few hours, and then they'll take naps, and they'll be up and down throughout the day and night. When they started living closer to humans, in order to avoid us, which they recognize was smart, and it is, they started becoming almost entirely nocturnal. So there are way more coyotes among us than we think. They're just avoiding us.